Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as a listener of Intelligent Medicine, you can try a bottle of their finest artisanal olive oil, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. I've been enjoying these harvest fresh olive oils for years. They are far and away the brightest, most lively, and flavorful olive oils I've ever tasted. Their antioxidants and polyphenols are off the charts because they're fresh from the harvest. They make store-bought olive oils taste dull and flat by comparison. Taste for yourself. Check out this generous trial offer and get your $39 bottle for a buck with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. Myfavoriteoliveoil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. I'm with Layla Mutin, who is our nutritionist in residence. Layla, introduce yourself. Your qualifications are...
Yes, I have a master's degree in nutrition and science. My bachelor's degree is in nutrition. My master's is in nutrition and exercise. My bachelor's is in nutrition and food science.
Okay, and you also have the CCN. What is it? Certification? What is
CDN. CDN is a New York State credential, certified dietitian nutritionist. I'm also a registered dietitian.
So legally, I can't give nutrition advice in the state of New York. You can.
I suppose, you're a CNS.
No,
come on, you're a certified nutrition specialist.
I
that's recognized.
This is an aside, but there's actually this issue of the monopolization of nutrition information. So if you were a very, very qualified layperson, maybe a biochemist with a PhD, and you decided to see clients and give them nutrition education, without a state-sanctioned CDN. Is that the initial CDN in New York?
CDN, but CDN.
It might be said that you're practicing nutrition without a license.
Here in New York, registered dietitians don't have licenses. If we did have licensing for RD in New York, that CDN would become LD, licensed dietitian.
Okay.
So my credentials then, if we had licensing in New York, would be MS, RD, LD.
Okay. And which is applicable in certain other states. And actually people have been brought up on charges because, say, they advocate a ketogenic diet and they're, biochemists, they're distinguished scientists, but they didn't go to RD school to get that.
Right.
That initial
they didn't get
name.
That particular. Yeah. And you know what? One of my dearest, I consider her a distant mentor, Liz Lipsky.
Yeah.
Liz Lipsky is one of probably the eminent nutritionists in our country, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. Her book, Digestive Wellness, is like a Bible to me. It's a reference book of mine. Mm-hmm. I love the work that she's done. Mm-hmm. But she had to move, I believe, from her home state of North Carolina Virginia because she was practicing with it was Artie's or licensed, I believe, in one of those states, and she had to move out of that licensing state to another state to practice. Ridiculous.
Bad state of
affairs. I think that's ridiculous.
If you're still in contact with her, give me a link to her because I'd love to get her on. I've had her on the program many, many years ago. I'd like to invite her back. All right, let's get to questions.
Oh, yes. We have from Bob. My wife, 68 years old, was diagnosed with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation and is taking Eliquis. She had an appendectomy 45 years ago, and I heard on your Memorial Day podcast that there's a high correlation between appendectomy and Parkinson's years later. She's 5'9", she's 150 pounds, otherwise in good health. Any recommendations?
Okay, all of that. Other stuff is extraneous. The fact that she's on Eliquis, that she has atrial fibrillation. The central question here is, because of having had an appendectomy, is she likely to come down with Parkinson's disease? And the answer
I should mention, Dr. Hoffman, I should also mention, Her mother passed away at 87 years of age from Parkinson's disease after 14 years.
Okay. Yeah. So that's another piece of information. But let's just hold that for later. Yeah. I did talk about an article, which based on a study, it's a survey, which shows that there is a correlation between appendectomy and the risk of Parkinson's disease. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, correlation is not always causation.
Right.
So we can't say, oh, you know, you had an appendectomy, so all of a sudden, you know, the brain-gut connection, you know, your brain's going to falter because you had an appendectomy.
Yeah.
I think that, if I'm not mistaken, the risk is in the double digits. In other words, you may have a 40% higher risk or 60% higher risk, but the risk to an individual over a lifetime of getting Parkinson's disease, while not inconsequential, is pretty low anyway. So,
yeah.
You know, that may mean that out of, 100 people, two without an appendectomy might get Parkinson's, and with an appendectomy, three might get Parkinson's disease. So what's up with that? Well, do you suddenly cut some neural circuit that causes your brain to go on the fritz when you get an appendectomy? No. What it's a sign of when you get an appendectomy is that something's wrong with your GI tract.
Yeah.
There may be an imbalance of bacteria in your gut. So it may be that appendectomy is associated with it. Having had an appendectomy is a sign that you have a disordered GI system. I'm going to knock wood here. I have not had an appendectomy. Have you had an appendectomy?
No, I've not. No.
They're probably.
I've had my tonsils out.
Me too. But that was the vogue. You know, they took them out of the top of the hat. They were always looking for an opportunity.
Oh no, I was snoring like a middle-aged man. They had to come out. I couldn't breathe.
Well, you know, I just had.
Anyway, we digress.
Yeah. So, but the point being is that requiring an appendectomy is a sign that you have an imbalance of bacteria in your gastrointestinal tract. And that may be the association with Parkinson's disease. There's a microbiome association. So, in other words, the appendectomy is not the cause. It's the marker.
Yeah.
So
interesting. So Bob is wondering, any recommendations for lifestyle modifications and supplements to tip the odds in her favor vis-a-vis Parkinson's and AFib?
Now, she has a family history, of Parkinson's.
Yeah. Her mother and passed away at 87, right?
So, 87, relatively older age. It's not like, galloping onset of Parkinson's at 50. So the incidence of Parkinson's is much higher in, octogenarians and nonagenarians. It would be interesting to do a genetic test on her to see if she has some issues that might predispose to Parkinson's. Now, there's not one single Parkinson's gene. Well, actually, there are some genes that highly predispose to Parkinson's, but that may be like 5% of people who get Parkinson's. Mostly, it's a lack of the antioxidant pathways like glutathione pathways, weakness in detoxification. These are things that predispose to Parkinson's.
So, living downstream from a local commercial farm that sprays incessantly.
But what's interesting
is Roundup on your lawn.
Yeah, but if you look at industrial workers, they're all exposed to the same amount of toxins. You never see a population where 100% of them come down with Parkinson's.
But many of them do come down with cancer.
Right. So what that suggests is that some people have more robust detoxification than others. And that we're actually able, with the tests that I'm now doing, we're beginning to skim the surface of what are these predisposing genes. And we can tell people, you need more selenium, you need more glutathione, you need more N-acetylcysteine, protective factors. Vitamin D may also be a protective factor for the brain. So, those are some things that we can do. I mean, there are studies that show that N-acetylcysteine, for example, is helpful for patients with Parkinson's. So that study came out recently. I would prefer, in a case like this, rather than giving generic suggestions, to individualize the suggestions and see if there's some sort of glitch that predisposes this person to Parkinson's. Okay, so that's a little bit of a dodge, but that's how we would work with a patient in the actual
exactly.
practice.
Exactly, exactly. You have to look at the whole person.
Can we
do a really, really good workup?
Can we do this now? Because we have to allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share a vital message with our listeners. This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you. And now back to our questions with Layla. What's up next, Layla?
We have a question from Dee. Dr. Hoffman, do you have any information on pneumatosis? I want to know what causes this condition, and is there any treatment to correct it? Pneumatosis.
Okay, well, you know, we preview these questions a little before because I don't want to seem like really dumb and be asked, you know, and even though it's like some obscure disease, I have the opportunity to preview the questions and I can look this stuff up. Okay, but frankly, when I heard about this pneumatosis, I said, man, I don't know, that's kind of an obscure disease.
Yeah.
I don't know that much about pneumatosis. I mean, pneumococcus, okay, that's the organism that causes pneumonia, pneumococcal pneumonia. That's pneumatosis. What the heck is that? All right. So I looked it up. And there is a condition called pneumatosis intestinalis. That's even more fancy sounding.
Intestinalis.
Or PI. Mm-hmm. Do you have PI? Also stands.
Do you have PI in your GI?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And I looked it up and it says it is defined as gas in the bowel wall. Okay.
Whoa, in the bowel wall. Wow.
Yeah. It is often first identified on abdominal radiographs or computed tomography scans. It's a radiographic finding and not a diagnosis. And the etiology varies from benign conditions to fulminant gastrointestinal disease. So, it could be something or it could just be nothing. And it kind of depends on the context. And this person's giving us very little context, right?
Yeah. Yeah. She wants to know the treatment, doesn't talk about any kind of symptoms or malaise or anything like that.
Okay. So,
you know, abdominal discomfort.
Let's not elaborate this. This actually means that there is a passage of the gas into the intestinal wall. So almost like bubbles of gas that appear in the intestinal wall. So, So one of the articles here says pneumatosis. There's also something called pneumocystis, which is another pneumocystis carini, which is an opportunistic infection in HIV patients. That's what, you know, that I'm familiar with. But pneumatosis intestinalis, there's an article here which says pneumatosis intestinalis in the adult, benign to life-threatening. Okay, it could be a sign of like ischemic bowel disease, you know, like literally, it's like kind of like a heart attack of the bowel where there's not enough blood flow to the bowel and the bowel is literally dying because it doesn't get any blood.
The bowel is having a PI.
You're right.
As opposed to an MI.
but interestingly, it could also be a sign of bacterial overgrowth. Yeah.
Oh.
Okay.
Hey, so this could be because of SIBO?
Yes. But it actually is in the lower GI tract. It's not in the upper GI tract.
The large bowel,
In the large bowel. So it says it's associated with numerous conditions and benign to life-threatening. The overall incidence in the general population, relatively uncommon. CT is the most sensitive imaging test for identification of PI. Unfortunately, because CT is so accurate, it picks it up when it could be just an incidental finding.
Huh.
So she gives us no context. She has no gastrointestinal symptoms. She has no history of ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease. They say the cause is not known. Two main theories. Gas dissects into the bowel wall from the intestinal lumen. A bacterial theory proposes that gas-forming bacteria enter the submucosa through mucosal tears or increased mucosal permeability and produce gas from the bowel. So we often talk about leaky gut syndrome. This could be, and I'm learning something here, because this could be a radiologic finding, a finding on an imaging test that suggests there's, you know, pretty profound leaky gut, because gas is literally leaking into the intestinal wall.
Wow. That's really something.
And the gas is hydrogen, which is characteristic of bacterial overgrowth. In isolation, I don't know what to tell this person. You know,
So it's quite possible that pneumatosis could be possibly a marker for leaky gut.
Yeah, I mean,
to some degree,
it could be nothing, and it could be something.
It could be nothing.
Yeah.
Okay. Very interesting. Dee, thank you for this question, but if you have any other information yourself about it or how you're experiencing it, let us know.
Or if there's any, other underlying conditions, you know, there's any...
Yeah, if there's any inflammatory bowel disease, if there's any bloating, discomfort, anything like that, I suppose, would be a place to start.
And then, we could say hypothetically, then the treatment would be, like a low FODMAP diet, the use of botanicals or even medications to suppress the growth of harmful bacteria. Xifaxan is the medication. The natural things would include things like berberine and oregano and garlic. Some of the things we commonly use for the treatment of bacterial overgrowth. But we don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know here.
We don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
So interesting question.
Yeah. Dee, thank you for that very thoughtful question.
Yeah.
All right.
But I don't want to trivialize it. It's not just like, a fancy word for gas in your bowel. You know, in other words, like run-of-the-mill, a sign of flatulence. No, it's a little bit beyond that, because it's invading the wall of the intestine.
Which is very interesting.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Okay. We've got a question here. Are there any harmful effects of taking hyaluronic acid and my diabetes medicine, which I take in the AM and PM? This person doesn't mention which diabetes meds, but I think hyaluronic acid is fairly innocuous.
Yeah,
really.
I don't think there's any possibility of interaction. I mean,
the
hyaluronic acid is sometimes used by people who like to use glucosamine sulfate.
Yeah.
And there have been some reports that glucosamine sulfate can raise blood sugar.
Okay.
But this is hyaluronic acid, which should not create that problem.
No. Okay. All right, so hyaluronic acid, no, that should be okay.
But, you know,
Thank you for that question.
But lest you, look, I mean, I want to leave the people with the impression there is strong evidence that glucosamine sulfate or glucosamine hydrochloride creates a problem. Because they say, and I'm looking it up, some early research had suggested that glucosamine might worsen insulin resistance. I think that research came out of the 1990s. But subsequent research suggests that it does not. It doesn't appear to affect blood sugar levels or insulin sensitivity. So, you know, I think all of those things are safe. I mean, just because glucosamine has the word glucose
in it doesn't mean that
the sugar... It's a glucosamine, so that doesn't really break down into glucose.
That's true. That's true. And, you know, with that initial early research that glucosamine may raise blood sugar levels, I remember practicing in a way that if somebody's trying to get their blood sugar down, they're doing everything perfectly.
Yeah.
But it's still up. Then I say, are you taking glucosamine? Then they stop.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to make a difference. And now this explains that
right.
there really wasn't any kind of
Yeah, remember that?
Any
that was sort of the the rumor, but it was, I think it's been subsequently disproven.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. So, and really in clinical practice, I've not seen a difference in blood sugar in eliminating glucosamine.
But
for
hyaluronic
a period
acid
of,
is fine.
Hyaluronic acid is fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And just to let this person know, they could go to somewhere like drugs.com,
yep.
look up their medications,
yep.
and look for any interactions, which I would advise anyone to do.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone would do. It's easy enough to do and take a look. There's a lot of comprehensive information there.
Yeah, big database.
Yeah. Now, let's see here. We've got a question from Jerry. I'm curious. I'm on a medication that does not allow me to have grapefruit. Is the grapefruit supplement in these fruit and vegetable pills okay for me to take? Or is it synthetic and I should ask my doctor? We can't get away from these fruit and vegetable questions.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that whole campaign keeps haunting us, you know, is that there's a very aggressive, especially AM radio campaign. So it's on all the stations where they're urging people to take fruit and veggie caps because, you know, if you don't eat enough fruits and vegetables, but also with outlandish claims that it cures all manner of disease. And there's all these really wacky testimonials with people who had god-awful problems and they started taking the fruit and veggie pills, just six capsules a day and whatever it was, whatever very advanced form of debilitation they experienced has abated. They never felt better in their lives. And it also, what also ticks me off about those commercials is they say, you know, I haven't bought any vitamins and supplements, any other supplements since I've done that, because everything's in there. Well, that couldn't be further from
everything's in there, and that's all. And I get all my 15 servings of fruits and vegetables or whatever it is. It's some ridiculous amount in the, yeah.
It's like, you know, astronaut food, you know, it's like sci-fi pill that astronauts were going to take instead of eating food, you know, that's going to satisfy all the nutritional needs. Okay, it doesn't do that. But interesting point that you bring up, because in the fruit pills, if there's a lot of grapefruit extract in there, it might have an impact on the disposition of your medication. And the way that
I would make sure that anybody taking medication where they can have grapefruit or citrus, and you know there will be other citrus in those fruit and veggie pills, I would take them off those fruit and veggie pills.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
And what that does is actually intensifies the effect of the medication. So if this is a medication that can cause liver problems, it's more likely to cause liver problems if you take it with lots of grapefruit. Now, I don't know if there's enough grapefruit in there to materially affect the drug. That I can't tell you. The other concern I would have, though, and there should be a warning on those products. I wonder if there is. If people take Coumadin, there's a lot of vitamin K in concentrates of fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
And so I'm pretty sure that if you're taking Coumadin, it could change the way that the Coumadin works and neutralize it, actually make it less effective so that you have thicker blood when you're wanting to have thinner blood.
Yeah. Yeah. Good thing to think about. Oh, my. Right.
So there are a couple of concerns with that. I mean, in addition to the fact that you shouldn't be taking it in the first place, you know.
Yes.
It's like people, you know, I keep saying, don't take it. And then people say, yeah, if I take it, what would you say if I took it? You know, what would be, could they interact or something? I'd say, no, but the whole point is don't. Do it.
Stop. Stop eating the plant-based burgers, which are full of who knows what. That's the other campaign.
Right. Well, you know, that's a matter, I think, a matter of choice. I am concerned about this plant hemoglobin, leg hemoglobin, which is kind of an unnatural protein that comes out of soy that is genetically modified, injected into yeast organisms, and the yeast organisms in a big vat produce a lot of bloody red leg hemoglobin, which kind of looks like blood and tastes like blood, contains some iron.
Oh, yuck.
But is that, I mean, is it really good for humans to eat a lot of that? I don't think that proposition's been tested, you know.
No, that's not a good idea.
That's on another subject.
It's a whole other conversation. Yeah. Wow.
All right. So, unfortunately, our time is limited.
And wow.
So, we'll save some of those questions for next week. Radioprogram at AOL.com is the destination for questions. And we'll be back next week. We're faithfully here to report on the news and to weigh in on your questions. So take advantage of this resource, radioprogram at AOL.com. Keep those questions coming. We enjoy answering them. We had some interesting ones today.
Yes. Thank you for joining us, everybody.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients regularly, along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.